Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have a ton of stuff, a lot of science to get through. We'll do it quickly. Gabe, we'll start with you and some of our emails.
This is an email from Thomas. He says, "Hello, gentlemen. Having heard your segment on people's emotional reactions to music, poetry, etc., I feel compelled to add my own experiences to the mix. This was the interview that we did last week in Nijmegen in the Netherlands on the aesthetic chills." Thomas writes, "My wife and I have been fortunate enough to have attended many symphony and large orchestra concerts. We often enjoy them when televised on PBS from the US and other public broadcasters. There have been numerous times when a moving piece of music causes me to have tears well up and I feel a sense of being gripped almost literally by the sound and vibrancy of the moment. It doesn't matter if it's a piece by Strauss, Mozart, or John Williams, if the mood of the moment is right, I am captured and display emotion. Many times I have felt embarrassment at being so emotional in public, but your segment has provided me with yet another unique aspect to my life, which is shared with others and has been scientifically studied. So thank you. Thank you for a fascinating and informative program. We both wish you," I'm assuming that's he and his wife, "wish you continued success and a long and healthy career in science broadcasting." Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you, Thomas.
Wonderful for sharing that. Yeah.
Nice to get a glimpse in your life, imagining you.
listening to this on PBS and being gripped by the moment, as you mentioned. That's just fascinating. Great.
Emoting with it.
Great stuff.
Another email here, this one from Peggy. "Hey there, love your show. Was listening to your segment on left-handedness yesterday, and I felt the need to comment. This was the research on the 10% of people who are left-handed, and that there may be a biological or an evolutionary connection to left-handedness and aggression, because it would have provided in certain...
And being competitive, right?
Yeah, aggression and competitiveness, and a new study showing that left-handers do tend to be slightly more competitive. She writes, "I'm the only one in the family of 10 kids who is left-handed. Even my parents were right-handed. So the 1 in 10 statistic is bang on. I have only ever felt special and unique because of my left-handedness. Luckily, I started school when the nuns were no longer forcing right-handedness on southpaws. I did learn to knit right-handed because there was no one to teach me how my brain really wanted the needles to work. My computer mouse absolutely has to be on the left, but I manage scissors and can openers well. I always brush my teeth with my left hand. I abhorred those ridiculous desks in uni, so at college, but was able to get 4 degrees despite those things.
Good job.
I would never describe myself as super competitive or aggressive. I'm interested in reading more about the study, though. How intriguing. Thank you for your terrific show." Thank you, Peggy, for writing in. I was going to say with your left hand, but you're typing this out, so it's not with
your left. She probably typed it with, lead with your left,
yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah, that's true. Oh. That's true. A lot of important vowels on that left side there.
Let me get right away, just an update. We spoke last year about something that the health secretary in the United States said and the president of the United States said with regard to a pain medication, acetaminophen, or Tylenol as it's known there. Also here in Europe, paracetamol. The recommendation made by those official figures was that pregnant women should not take this because of the risk of autism, and the study that they were referencing in that recommendation, we talked about this at length, it was a meta-analysis of 46 different studies. They cherry-picked 2 of those and said that there is a clear link between the use of this pain medication, acetaminophen, and your child or your kid getting autism. That is not based on science. So first of all, that's not true. But what happens when an official figure like the President of the United States or the Health Secretary of the United States makes these recommendations? The Lancet looked at it and they did good science. They compared in the emergency room setting, so outpatient prescriptions for acetaminophen by women who are pregnant between the age of 15 and 44 and women who are not pregnant between the age of 15 and 44. Pregnant women... It went down by 10% how much Tylenol they were prescribed compared to the other group. In the other group, there was no change. So 10% fewer prescriptions for a pain medication that helps these people deal with pain and possibly bring fever down, which is very important for the development of your child. There's no doubt about that. And compared to the other group, no change. So when these recommendations are made and they're not based on rigorous science, they have an effect. That is the power of political influence when it is mixed together with medicine.
This is also why just recently we talked on the show about similar messaging beginning to happen with SSRIs, mm-hmm. antidepressants, and pregnant women, and how the evidence isn't it's inconclusive. And that's the most important thing we can say, so that a similar drop doesn't unnecessarily happen, because that can have real consequences. I'm going to jump to another update myself on an interview we did 2 years ago now, mm-hmm. at this point, maybe 2.5. It's because there's a viral video on TikTok that was recorded on a U.S. airplane where a woman is getting kicked off the plane because she had her phone on blast, as I'm going to put it. She was blasting the sound of her phone. She was
without wearing headphones or earbuds.
Yeah.
So everyone else around her had to hear what was on her phone.
Right. Yeah. And so she's about to be escorted and then is escorted off the airplane. And she's become kind of the scapegoat, or the viral scapegoat, for a much bigger issue that we've talked about in the past. This is phone noise and the erosion of social norms. So these spaces that used to be quiet, people are coming into them, whether it's a restaurant, a bus, a tram, a train, could be anywhere, and they're filling that space with noise. And most of us don't like that, because I don't need to know which TikTok video you're watching and swiping through, right? None of us do it.
Don't like that. Right. It's putting it lightly. So a lot of people just hate it, right?
Hate it. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of people's blood boil, to be honest. And I think it's therefore worth repeating. Also, in light of that viral video, there was a separate U.S. airline that declared officially, and I think it's the first one, to say, we are going to kick people off sometimes.
We have the right to kick you off the plane if you're listening to your phone without headphones.
Right. And that is a new policy that got some attention. Yep. In the meantime, all of us are out in the real world and we are getting blasted with the sound. What can you do to stop that? What should you do? What actually works? I'm going to just repeat 3 points from this study that we talked about a while ago. And they are this. The study shows that if somebody stands up to confront the person who has the loud phone, mm-hmm. and says, hey, you need to turn your sound down or put your headphones on, that will not really change much in terms of the whole group, like if this is a group setting. So all of the bystanders, all of the people sitting there quietly, they're not going to really be sure who's right or wrong here. They may all agree with that person, but nobody knows that everyone agrees. Mm. And so that doesn't have much of a social effect. That doesn't reinforce the good norm, the quiet.
What does?
So what you should do there in that situation is, if somebody stands up and says, hey, put those headphones on, support the person confronting. That shows everyone in the larger group that we share this norm together, that we all kind of believe in this. And the more, the merrier. Now, if you want to do...
So it's not only the way to stop the person from doing this, it's also to reinforce the norm itself?
In society.
In society.
Amongst all of these other people, to make sure that we all are sure and know that we feel the same way. Because there's a lot of uncertainty there.
The group knows best.
Yeah. Second point. If you want to confront and tell that person, hey, turn your music down or put the headphones on, the best thing you can do, and it's connected to what I just said, is talk to someone around you first. Kind of get them on your team. Hey, real quick, is that annoying you too? Am I going crazy? Am I the only one here? And get a couple of people kind of on board before you do the confrontation. They're more likely to support you.
Yeah.
And the whole group, you're going to have a larger effect on the group, because now they see, look, we all feel this way.
So maybe get like a reassuring look from the people around you.
At the very least.
Before you intervene.
Yes. And I've done that one in practice. And it helped me feel better about the situation. Really, it did. The third and final and most important point, keep yourself safe. Do not do anything. You don't have to do anything. This is not your problem, noise, phone noise. It's not your problem to solve single-handedly. And when you engage with people who are doing that, there is the risk of escalation. There's the risk of physical violence. And nobody is asking you to put yourself in that situation for a larger societal problem that could and probably should be solved either with corporate rules or signage, mm-hmm. even clear social norms, because I think a lot of us out there want to reinforce the idea that quiet places that were quiet can and still should be quiet, even if technology has changed and given us all a bunch of videos to watch whenever we want to watch them.
All right. Sticking with social norms, I got a study here out of Peking University and Cornell and Queen's University on Lake Ontario in Canada about humor and social norms. And this was a series of seven different experiments. I'm gonna shorten it big time to get to the stuff that I've really found interesting. And so I think people can probably understand is that the looser a society is, the funnier the people who are in that society can be. That is the conclusion.
The looser?
The tighter, let's say, the other way. The tighter the society is, the harder it is for you to be funny if you live and grew up in that society. And what they did here was they first compared people from the United States and China, and they wanted to see if first they appreciate humor in the same way. So they gave them a selection of jokes that had been pre-selected.
Ah, okay.
And they wanted to see how they assessed them. They both found them, or they found the funny ones equally as funny and the not funny ones also not funny. So their appreciation of humor, their ability to find a joke funny, was almost exactly the same. What was not the same was their ability to produce humor or be funny. And how they did that was they showed them pictures and then told these people, write a caption about the picture you're looking at in the funniest way possible. And that is going to be judged by an objective, like outsiders who are not only in that culture. So a diverse jury looked at these captions.
This is the quote unquote New Yorker challenge where you get a cartoon drawing and it's your job. There are actually competitions. It's your job to write.
What is the funniest thing you can say about that picture? The American participants were way funnier than the Chinese. So although they both were able to find jokes funny, they couldn't produce humor to the same degree. Americans were funnier.
Although there, I would add a caveat because as you were saying that, I can picture that task. I've tried it before. I submitted. There used to be a competition where you could try to win, I think, cash for being the funniest.
Okay.
And so I'm aware of the format. I'm aware of the feeling. I think I know where it should go. Whereas somebody who's coming in blind to that may not have, this may be a totally new cultural construct, if that makes sense.
They wanted to include other cultures just to make sure that it wasn't just China versus America here. They included Norway, India, Germany, all those three known as relatively tight cultures compared to Australia and Brazil. The tight cultures were not as good at being funny as the looser cultures. Hmm. And why that is, I mean, I guess you could say that possibly in those cultures, there's more of a punishment for making jokes. It's something you just don't do. And because you don't do it, you're not as good at it. It's harder for you to break transgressions if you're afraid of, I don't know, getting in trouble or possibly, incurring punishment.
The last
experiment was they tried to find a causal link for this. So before asking them to do this task of creating a funny joke, or in this case it was to finish a joke, so they set the bowling pins up, the joke they started, and they wanted to see if members from America or China could finish it. What they did before that was they primed them. Half of these groups were to read about a very strict society. So you're reading an excerpt about a society that's very strict, and the other group reads an excerpt about a society that's completely free. Mm. Is there a causal link? Can you prime people to be funny? And yes, you could. Absolutely. So you read about this free society where you can say whatever you want. You were funnier regardless of where you were from, China or the U.S., you were funnier if you're thinking about a free society than if you're thinking about a restrictive society where you can't, where for goodness sake, you can't say anything wrong. So there is, if it's at the front of your mind, there is a way to, I don't know, influence people's humor or
allow
make them funnier
or allow them
to be funny.
Yeah. Hugely fascinating area of research. Priming people with text and what that can do to them.
I cannot believe that effect. If you guys want to read about this study, there are a number of other experiments in the study. It's called Cultural Tightness Reduces Humor Production, evidence from multiple countries. Again, Cornell University, Peking University, and Queen's University on Lake Ontario.
And for those of you who are interested in how to, or in the study behind how to be a better bystander, how to quiet the world, how to get rid of the phone noise. That study is called The Sound of Silence, The Importance of Bystander Support for Confronters in the Prevention of Norm Erosion. And that's in the British Psychological Society Journal.
Boy, we barreled through a lot today. You guys have anything to say on anything we've said? As always, let us know at sudw.com.
By the time most of you listen to this, it was 2 weeks ago at the time of recording that it was a Friday night and it was beautiful spring weather. And my wife very, very lovingly, generously turned to me and she's like, don't you want to go out and do something? Don't you want to go hang out with some friends? Go into town, have some beers, go see your old buddy Gavin. And I said to her, I would love to do that. And I did end up doing it the next day. But I said, I would love to do that. I'm too tired. The whole idea of going out and doing that and then feeling the results the next, I'm too tired for that. And she turned to me and said, oh, right. I think you probably have spring fatigue.
Fatigue because of the spring. It has been really wonderful, the weather here.
It has.
In Germany. But you're tired because of that.
That was her assumption. And if that sounds wildly new or strange to you, it's because that idea, that concept doesn't really exist, as far as I know, as far as we know, in the English-speaking world. But Germans wholeheartedly believe in it. And now, finally, we have a study out of Switzerland on whether or not it's true.
Science Unscripted.
I'm Dr. Christine Blume. I'm a sleep researcher at the University of Basel and the Psychiatric Hospital of the University of Basel. And I've recently published a study on a phenomenon we call spring fatigue.
Christina, for our listeners around the world who may not know what spring fatigue is, could you fill us in right at the beginning here?
Yeah. So spring fatigue is a phenomenon that we see in the German-speaking countries, so Germany, Switzerland, and Austria. And people say, well, I'm tired, I have a lack of energy. And that's what I feel specifically during spring.
Right. So I'm feeling slower. Like right at the period of the year where I feel like a lot of people in the English-speaking world would say, mm-hmm. I'm rejuvenated, I'm full of life, everything's blooming, I want to go outside. In the Germanic world, people say that the opposite happens, that they're tired and they want to sleep.
Yeah, it's weird, no? I also thought, well, the German people always need something to complain about. Because, I mean, what we would expect is that, yes, people go outside, they enjoy the sun, and they're just glad that the dark season is over.
You were looking into this phenomenon that 50% of people in Germany, at least, say they have. What did you find out?
So we looked at it because there was no scientific study on it. And I mean, if a phenomenon is so prevalent, then there should be something on it. So what we found was that we do not find that people are measurably more fatigued or more tired during spring or any other season. So neither during summer, autumn or winter. And our interpretation is that this is much more of a cultural phenomenon affecting the way we perceive symptoms rather than actually affecting our fatigue levels.
So how did you conduct the study then? Was it survey-based or were you relying on previous surveys that just asked people, how energetic are you today? And that was asked across the board 365.25 days a year. And then you found out there that it was roughly the same energy levels? Or how did you do it?
So we invited people to participate in our survey, and we sent them, once they agreed, we sent them questionnaires every 6 weeks. And then in every questionnaire, we asked how energetic that you feel during the past 4 weeks, you know, during day-to-day work, how fatigued were you, how well did you sleep, how much did you sleep, to really catch the phenomenon. And what we then in the analysis saw was that there was no single period in time where people were more fatigued than at any other time.
So what is the basis then for a German person right now? Because it's been, the weather has been phenomenal the last couple
Absolutely,
of weeks.
Yeah.
If I'm a German person right now and I'm saying I've got this spring fatigue, what is going on with that person? Why, what, when you said that it's cultural, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the discrepancy we have to explain, right? Almost 50% of our sample saying I identify as someone being affected by spring fatigue, but then we cannot measure it. So our explanation is that it's a cultural phenomenon. We could also say it's a psychological phenomenon where attention to the symptoms plays a huge role. But at the same time, also, this word, which in German we call Frühlingsmüdigkeit, or in English, spring fatigue, that word exists. And that allows people to describe how they feel as compared to other seasons. And all in all, that then leads to or shapes the perception of symptoms and leads to people saying, I'm affected by spring fatigue.
Is there possibly a psychological component reflects something real? And what I mean there is that these last couple of weeks where the weather was beautiful, I began to kind of pay more attention to my energy levels because I felt like I should be out there enjoying it. And then on the days where I didn't have that energy to go do it, I noticed it more than on a dreary, gray, drizzly day where I think, yeah, it's fine to lay on the couch and drink a cup of tea and do nothing, right? Could that be connected to it?
That could well be, yeah. The phenomenon which you just described is what we call cognitive dissonance. It's a well-described phenomenon in psychology, and it describes a situation where a person, for example, thinks, I should go outdoors, I should maybe do sports again because the weather's so nice, but I don't really feel it. It doesn't match my energy levels. And to reduce this cognitive dissonance, because these two levels don't match, they look for an explanation. And I mean, spring fatigue is a perfect explanation and the perfect excuse for not having to go outdoors and, you know, make use of the nice weather and the sunshine.
And I suppose I looked kind of internally there at how the human brain might be dealing with this. What about the externals that are very real and measurable? Increased pollen levels, lots of people sniffling, sneezing, headachy, possibly taking antihistamines. I mean, that would make you sleepy as well. But couldn't there...
Yeah.
Or to phrase it differently, wouldn't it be surprising for that not to have an effect on energy levels?
The issue here is that, so we don't find this effect. So there is, in the first place, there is nothing to explain. And what really struck me also when I was researching some time ago about this phenomenon is that you find all these potential explanations out there, but there was no single study that ever looked at whether this phenomenon exists.
When you say that the word spring fatigue gives Germans or German speakers kind of like an excuse or it justifies them talking about how tired they are, could this be like a wake-up call for mental health researchers that a lot of Germans are just really tired or depressed or just they aren't feeling great? Could that be what's going on?
In our sample, people were all the time relatively fatigued. We don't really know where that comes from, but it is interesting to see. What I would recommend is, what I think maybe we could use this result also for is really a wake-up call in terms of don't explain those symptoms away by just spring fatigue. But do pay attention to the symptoms. And if you feel that they are burdening, then do see a doctor.
One thing that kind of jumps out at me about your work here is that there was no drop in fall or winter. Isn't that that's the classic period where people say I'm lethargic, I'm especially kind of the gray January, the gray February. You can't come out of your little cocoon that you developed over winter. Mm-hmm. People there are equally as energetic, or they describe themselves that way in surveys, as summer.
Yeah, that's what we find. However, what we did find was that when the, what we say, photoperiod was long, so when there was a lot of daylight during the summer, then people did sleep a little less. And in the dark season, when the days were shorter, they did sleep a bit more. And this is very well what we would expect from previous research, and may also explain why people were actually not more fatigued, because they did sleep a bit more, so they made up for this, sleep need.
Is it fair to say that that might be the most important part of your research here? I mean, for all of our people, our listeners out there listening to this in English and who are like, spring fatigue, what? What on earth are you talking about? But who probably have at some point bought into the idea of, you know, this fall or winter lethargic state, that it's just... That's not true. People have the same energy levels, roughly speaking, year round.
Yeah, I mean, certainly variations across seasons in the way we sleep or in our sleep need are certainly something that we see here and which are important to recognize. But I also find it just super interesting. I mean, it's a German example, but it at the same time shows how culturally coined terms or phenomena can actually shape how we perceive symptoms. And I think that is super interesting.
That was Christine Bluma speaking to us from Basel, Switzerland, where she is a sleep researcher, but she's also a podcaster. Mm-hmm. And if you know German, Überschlafen is the podcast if you want to listen to that. It's in the German language.
Deutschlandfunk Nova is where she publishes that. And I'll just say again what I think the most important takeaway for me from that whole discussion was, it's that we tend to have the same energy levels year round. And again, survey based, right? That's not the same as measuring what people actually do in their day-to-day lives, how many steps they take, how many times they exercise per week. That's not, it is different, but if you ask people, hey, where you at energy-wise, that's going to hold stable throughout the year, which for me feels really great, because I did not believe the German spring fatigue thing really, truly, deeply in my bones. But the idea that in the winter period you stop, or not stop doing things, but your energy levels drop, that I would have said yes to, just intuitively.
Yeah. For a bit of perspective, I remember an email that was sent to us from the plains in Saskatchewan, where we have a miner who spends his days 2.5 kilometers underground. So when he's on the day shift, he doesn't see any light. Even on his drive into work, he sees a bit of the rising sun, and then does 12 hours underground and then comes out when it's dark. So if he has a reason to complain. And I remember when he wrote in this email, he wrote, this is Adam, shift work is torture on my circadian rhythm. And then he goes on and on about what it's like to live without having any light. It is a real thing. If you are having problems with your circadian rhythm, people who do the night shift, there are studies on this. It leads to a much, much higher prevalence in depression and all kinds of mental health issues. So that is not something to be taken lightly. We were joking a lot during this interview because it allowed us to kind of make fun of the German people. And I love doing that.
Well, yeah. But
circadian rhythms are very serious, you know? And the impact when your circadian rhythm is disrupted, the impact that can have on your sleep, obviously, and how you feel can be huge, you know?
And connected with that, again, I believe it was an associative study that I saw connecting it to higher prevalences of cancer and other physiological, which would make sense if your ability to sleep has been massively disrupted.
Oh, fatality rate, right?
Yeah, it has knock-on effects
mortality rate, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, kind of a fun way to talk about something that is very serious.
And what do you guys think about the idea of the German-speaking people complaining about fatigue in the spring? Have you heard about it? What do you think about it? Let us know at su@dw.com.
Science. Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.